You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Last week, we discussed how God chooses failures like Moses. You think that the story would be over at this point, and Moses just does fabulously throughout the rest of his career, and yet we see God also uses failures just like Moses. We pick up in the 21st verse of chapter 4, the Lord said to Moses, "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do. But I will harden his heart. He will not let the people go." More on this next week. "Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so that he may serve me. But you refused to let him go. So I will kill your firstborn son." Speaking of Pharaoh, more on that in 2 weeks. Verse 24. "At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah, his wife, took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it." In case you're confused or there's any ambiguity, the "it" there refers to the son's foreskin, to his feet. "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me," Zipporah said. So the Lord let him alone. At that time that she said the bridegroom of blood, of course she was referring to circumcision. I don't know. I honestly don't. I'm in good company. Nobody seems to know here. God wants to kill Moses. Up until this point, he's so patient and kind, and all of a sudden, he meets him at this lodge, and he's about to kill him. Let me make a few observations, and then we'll keep moving. First, this was a threat. If God had any desire to take Moses' life, he could have done so in a millisecond. He was threatening Moses' life. Why is it that Zipporah immediately circumcises one of Moses' sons when this threat begins to occur? It was because Moses had been delaying circumcising his son. What is circumcision? Well, I'm not going to get into the medical practice. I'm going to speak, of course, of the theological implications of circumcision to the Hebrew people. To be circumcised meant that you were engaging in loyalty to God and to his people. So much so that in Genesis chapter 17, when this was first initiated with Abraham, God said to Abraham, if anyone doesn't circumcise their son, particularly on the eighth day, they should be cut off from the people. So here we have Moses, the great lawgiver and leader, and he's going out there to lead God's people into what? Into a whole new nation. And what's the inauguration into the people of God? Circumcision. And he hasn't circumcised his own son. So Moses would soon be getting others to follow God. But first, he needed to get himself to follow God. This is what we refer to as an integrity check. Where up until this point, Moses was 80. We're going to learn that in chapter 7, verse 7. God had let this go. But as soon as Moses said, I'm going to step up into a position of leadership, God drew the line. And he said, no further. We are going to deal with this right now. If you're going to lead my people, then you got to lead them at least into the covenant of God. And so this is why God took this stance. At that point, everything's cool. Moses told Aaron everything the Lord had sent him to say, and also all about the signs he had commanded him to perform. Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites. Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and they worshiped. This is what tech people refer to as the early adapters, the people on the curve that you want to win before you start to really roll out a plan. If Moses could win these leaders of Israel, presumably the rest of the people would follow. And so he speaks to the leaders first. And after he does this, he says, are you guys on board? Because there was quite a lot to lose by just leaving the greatest empire known to man at the time. This was quite scary. And indeed, as we read through the rest of the story in the first five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, we see that the people almost have Stockholm syndrome with Egypt. They keep talking about Egypt with this, you know, this incredible nostalgia about the meat and the water that they had back there. And Moses is trying to get them in right from ground zero. Are you guys in? Chapter 5. They've been through the dress rehearsal. They're ready for the main show. Moses hasn't been in this court of Pharaoh for 40 years. Now he's 80. He's walking right into Pharaoh's court with his brother Aaron. And he says, this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness. Pharaoh retorted, who is Yahweh? Yahweh? Yahoo? Who are we talking about here? I don't know Yahweh. Now, there's a sense in which Pharaoh was saying, I've never heard that name before. Which local deity is this? Is this like one of the great deities in the pantheon of Egyptian deities? I've never heard that name. But there's another sense in which Pharaoh is saying, I don't care who Yahweh is. Like if somebody came into your office and they said, you know, Bill from upstairs says that we really got to get the TPS reports in on time. And you say, who is Bill that he's telling me what to do? You tell Bill to come down here and tell me myself, right? Well, who is Yahweh? I don't know. I don't know the name. And who is he to even tell? I'm Pharaoh. I'm the son of a god. I am a god. Why should I obey Yahweh and let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh, and I will not let Israel go. This would be to commit econocide, to kill your economy, to let all the Hebrew slaves just walk out the door. But here we should pause and remember, God had predicted all of this to Moses. He said right from the beginning, Exodus 3, verse 19, Pharaoh will not be persuaded, and it will take a heavy hand before he lets the people out. Moses and Aaron must not have reflected on that very much, because you can tell at this point they start to get a little bit skittish. They say the God of the Hebrews, they drop the Yahweh part. You don't like me saying Yahweh, I won't say Yahweh anymore. Y'all just say the God of the Hebrews. Is that okay, Pharaoh? He's like, yeah, that's fine. God of the Hebrews has met with us. And he said, let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword. Two problems. First, 3 days? I thought this was supposed to be permanent. And this comes straight from God's lips, so to speak. God says, just ask Pharaoh for 3 days. 3 days. But I thought the Exodus was supposed to be a one-way ticket out of Egypt. And God is the one who's saying this, and Moses is repeating it. What is with that? For one, in the ancient Near East, in their culture at that time, they were very reluctant to begin negotiations with a big slam dunk ask. Not like today. Today we say, you know, I'll give you $100,000 for the house, and the other party comes back and says $350,000. You know, we meet somewhere in the middle. Back then they would just ask for a little bit and then ask for more and more and more. Think of Abraham in Genesis chapter 18. God, will you spare the city of Sodom if you find 50 righteous? God says, yeah. 50 righteous? Yeah, 50. God, 45? Yeah, 45, yeah. 40, God. 40? Sure, 40 righteous. 30, God. Huh? 30, sure. Oh, God, I don't even want to say it. 20 righteous? 20 righteous. What, God, oh, forgive your servant. 10 righteous. It's like an ancient Near Eastern haggler, you know what I mean? He's haggling them down until he gets them down to 10, and then he says, okay, I don't even want to go below that. That's the threshold. We're done. And here he's saying, let's start with 3 days. And by Pharaoh saying no to this, that is showing what an obstinate, cruel dictator he even is. There are no negotiations. Another way to interpret this is that he's using a Hebrew idiom, much in the same way that Jonah traveled into Nineveh for 3 days. This could be idiom in the sense that asking for 3 days would be like if I was sitting over at your house and I said to you, can you pass me the remote control? Now, is it that I just like to hold that electronic device in my hand and that just makes me very comforted? Or is it that I want to turn off Gilmore Girls and put on something with respect on television? You know, you're talking to your old man as a high schooler. Can I have the keys tonight, Dad? Well, it's not that I just want the keys in my pocket. I want the car. Pharaoh, we want to go out for 3 days, and what's that mean? We want out of here. Could be idiom, not sure. regardless, Pharaoh won't deal with it. What about this part, though? That first part came right from God. 3 days. This part here, or he may strike, he, God, may strike us with plagues or with the sword. God never said this. We read it ourselves. Exodus 3:18. You can read it. It's verbatim, everything so far. Moses and Aaron, skittish. Right when they're standing there with Pharaoh, and he says, who is Yahweh? Who are you? No, we're not going to let them go. And all of a sudden they say, oh, okay, well, just 3 days. And if you don't let us go, he's going to kill all of us. And you won't have slaves anyways. That's their maneuver here. For one, this is a terrible mischaracterization and distortion of God. That he's going to kill his own people. Why? Because Pharaoh won't let him go. Moses made this up. I hope you can see that. This does not come from God. God would never do such a thing. In fact, he promised, those people are going to go with me to this mountain, and then they will return to the promised land. It's never going to happen. What is Moses doing? He's making God's words more palatable. Or to put that a different way, he's softening the message. So that Pharaoh seems a little bit easier for him to ingest, and it's better for the negotiations. In other words, God's words weren't very good. God didn't really think about the negotiation process, at least to the extent that the brilliant Moses and Aaron did. And so Moses and Aaron needed to really fix this and help God with his words. Think about it. It's much easier to say, Pharaoh, if you don't let us go, God, Yahweh, is going to judge us, rather than what God actually said, which was, God is going to judge you. Now that would bring a little bit of trepidation to say something like that to a man who believes that he himself is a god. So he's not off to a good start. Let's see how this works. When you twist God's words, how does it go? Well, we read in verse 4, but the king of Egypt said, Moses and Aaron, why are you talking or taking the people away from their labor? He just completely ignores this. Why are you taking them away from their labor? Get back to work. Then Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now numerous and you're stopping them from working. That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people. He said this, you are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. You say, who cares? I've never made a brick in my life. To make bricks, you need the clay and you need the soil and you need the sun and you also need straw to mix it in. This is half of the work, to go out there and scavenge all the straw and then make the bricks and then move them to where Pharaoh wants them to be moved. So now he's saying, we're going to double the work. We're going to double it up. Oh, you're asking for a little three-day, little jaunt out into the wilderness to worship your God? Oh, okay. Well, we're going to double your workload, is what he's saying. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy. That is why they're crying out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. They want some kind of a religious holiday off. They're slaves. You don't get religious holidays off in Egypt. You're slaves, and you're lazy, and you're coming up with some fanciful excuse as to why you shouldn't work. Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies. This is part and parcel with what we know in extra-biblical history at the time. This entire industry of making bricks in ancient Egypt in the 17th and 18th dynasty was par for the course. James Hoffmeyer is an archaeologist and an Egyptologist. He says in the tomb of Rechmeyer, who was a vizier, a prime minister of Pharaoh Thutmose III in western Thebes, we find a painted scene depicting groups of foreigners making bricks. Look at that. In the tomb of the Pharaoh, what time period? 1479 to 1425 BC. When was the Exodus again? 480 years from 967 BC, according to 1 Kings chapter 6. You say, you're losing me here. Let me just make it easy. The Exodus was in 1446 BC, and right in the middle of that reign of Thutmose III, we have paintings on the wall, not of Egyptians, but of foreigners making bricks, precisely as we're reading here. Well, The slave drivers, they do their job. They go out and they say, this is what Pharaoh says. I will not give you any more straw. Go and get your own straw wherever you can find it, but all your work will not be reduced at all. So the Hebrews scattered all over Egypt just to gather stubble. They couldn't even get straw. Straw was so hard to find, but just to get the little parts of the straw, the stubble, to make their bricks. The slave drivers kept pressing in on them, saying, complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you did have the straw. And Pharaoh's slave drivers beat the Israelite overseers they had appointed, demanding this: why haven't you met your quota of bricks yesterday or today as before? So if the Israelite foremen, the Israelite overseers, these are the ones getting the beatings, that's going to trickle down to the slaves themselves. The Israelite overseers went and appealed, or cried out in Hebrew, to whom? To God? To Moses? Did they cry out to Moses? Did they cry out to Aaron at least? No, they cry out to Pharaoh. Oh, how different that is than in Exodus 2:23, when it says that the slaves were crying out and groaning out to God, and God heard their prayer. And he acted. He remembered his covenant, and he acted on it. Here, they're crying out to the devil, in other words. They think this is a big misunderstanding. So they say, why have you treated your servants this way, Pharaoh? Your servants are given no straw, yet we are told, make bricks. Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with you, with your people. It's not with you, Pharaoh. It's your people. They think this is some issue between management and ownership. Pharaoh, we're here to correct this. You know, your people are really out of line. I don't know if you realize that the managers and the foremen, they're making us get the straw. This isn't good for business. It's not good for morale. We're exhausted. We're falling over dead. I don't know if you knew this, but your people are out of line. It's their fault. Not realizing that the orders came from Pharaoh himself. So Pharaoh says, lazy. That's what you are. Lazy. That is why you keep saying, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Now, get to work. You won't be given any more straw, yet you must produce your full quota of bricks. Oh my God. Just imagine that. You think, oh, we're just going to clear this up with Pharaoh. We've been hardworking this whole time. We've never rebelled. No revolts. Hey, who is the one that screwed this up in the first place anyways? Like work was par for the course. You know what I mean? It was backbreaking, and there was whippings and beatings, but nothing like this. You got to gather the straw and the stuff. Who was it that came on this? It was Moses and Aaron. When they showed up, then this happens. So they leave right from Pharaoh. They go right to Moses and Aaron. And poor Moses and Aaron are probably sitting there like, how'd it go, guys? Did it go okay? They said, may the Lord look on you, Moses, and judge you. You have made us obnoxious to Pharaoh, literally a stench in his nostrils. And his officials have put a sword in their hand to kill us. May God judge you. Let me paraphrase. Moses, ever since you came in to lead, things have only gotten worse. You know, before, it was just normal bad. Now it's double bad. And it's only a couple days into your leadership, and you're some weird 80-year-old guy that came out of the desert saying God spoke to you. Yeah, we saw the miracles, we saw the sign, we saw all that. But we're also seeing the entire group of slaves, now they're being worked nearly to death. This is Moses' biggest fear being realized right before our eyes. Do you remember what he said in chapter 3? What if they say that they don't believe me? Who am I to rule these people, to judge these people? Who am I to do this job? And here we see Moses right square in the face with the leaders of Israel. And they're asking these very questions that have been haunting Moses for decades. Moses is speechless. He doesn't know how to retort. He has no answers. Who am I to lead these people? What if they don't believe me? God should have sent somebody else. So he leaves. He goes right back and speaks with the Lord. And he says, "Why, Lord, why have you brought this trouble on your people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's brought trouble on this people. And you have not rescued your people at all." Quite an indictment, if you ask me. God has told Moses his plan from start to finish. And yet Moses, at the first sign of trouble, is saying, "God, you haven't done a single thing." Is that true? You have not rescued your people at all? It certainly felt that way. I could understand how he would feel that way. The gears weren't in motion at this point. There wasn't a single slave that had been rescued. And Moses is looking like a failure, and publicly, the thing with Pharaoh went badly. It probably felt that way. The question is, was it true? Well, Moses' ingenuity, that certainly failed. His whole idea about adding to the scriptures, adding to what God said, that part, that definitely failed. That wasn't God's fault, though. You know what I mean? God never told him to say that to Pharaoh in the first place. Moses couldn't see God's plan. He heard it. God said, "This is the way we're going to do it," in chapter 3. He couldn't see it. He couldn't see the end from the beginning. So it felt a certain way, like he was going through failure and suffering. But he didn't have the bird's eye view of omniscience to look at the world through omniscient eyes. He couldn't see that. Of course it felt that way. His fears were beginning to burble over once again. As though, you know, he thought probably, once I start to lead for God, that's when the fears are going to go away. Maybe my insecurities will disappear. And yet they're getting thrown right in his face. Nobody's responding the way that they should. Here's the kicker. All these things are true. Yet, according to what we've been reading thus far, God's promises and his plan have nothing to do with the conditions of humans, least of all Moses. God's promises and plan are unconditional. Let me put that a different way. Once the infallible God pronounces a word of what he's going to do, it's going to happen one way or another. So for Moses to look at all this checklist of everything that's going wrong, true. You don't have the ingenuity to outwit a Pharaoh into giving away his slave labor. Okay, you don't see God's plan. True. It's all true. There's just one big part that you're missing, which is that you can't see the promises of God the way that you should. Chapter 6. How might God reply? He says, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go." See, God just doesn't struggle with insecurity the way that Moses does. "Well, you haven't done anything at all. You haven't done a single thing, God." God's not there going, "Oh, I've got a lot of things to defend myself with. You know, I've been working from eternity to eternity. You know, remember those miracles I could do through you and that whole plan? And I've been working to get you guys built up." And he doesn't get into any of that. He doesn't feel the need to defend himself. He's just, "I'm going to do what I'm going to do." That's what he says. "I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I appeared to them as El Shaddai, God Almighty. But by my name Yahweh, I didn't make myself fully known to them." Sorta, kinda. I mean, the name Yahweh appears in the book of Genesis 164 times. He didn't make his name known. It's on the lips of the patriarchs or the people in Genesis 34 times. They use the name Yahweh. So how could they say they never knew me by that name, or they never used that name? I like the NIV here. "I did not make myself fully known to them." In Hebrew thinking, what does it mean to know something? Well, at the least, it means to propositionally know that something is true. But the Hebrew word yada means not just to propositionally know it, but to personally know it. This is the word used for sexual intimacy between a man and a wife. This isn't just saying, "Well, academically I know what happens when coitus occurs between a husband and wife." This is saying, I know what that experience is like. This is saying, they knew the name. Did they know what I was going to do through the miracles? Did they know what I was going to do in revealing my character through the law, rescuing my people? They didn't know me to that level, and now you do. So Moses is saying, you haven't done anything at all. First, he says, actually, I've been working through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now I'm revealing something to you in a progressive, revelatory, revealing sort of a way to let you know who I am. I established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan where they resided as foreigners. I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I've remembered my covenant. Go back and say to the Israelites, Moses, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with a mighty act of judgment. I will take you as my own people. I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land that I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. You haven't done anything at all. And God says, I am the Lord. I'm not here to defend myself against your accusations because you got your feelings hurt today. I am the Lord, and this is what I'm going to do. Are you going to jump on board or not? Well, we pick up in verse 9, Moses went back, apparently. Talk about a halftime coach speech, you know, you're ready for the third quarter. He gets back in there. But the Israelites didn't listen. He says, God has just told me he's in charge. He's going to move. He told me everything, but they didn't listen. Why? Because of their discouragement and their suffering, their harsh labor. You could actually hear the words of God, but because of your suffering and being in a position where it's not, it isn't flagrant, you know, acute suffering. It's just that you're discouraged. That God's word doesn't pierce your heart. They couldn't believe it. They wouldn't believe it. Well, the Lord said to Moses, well, they won't listen. Go and tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of this country. Moses is like, what? If the Israelites won't listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me? Since I speak with faltering lips. There it is again. Remember he said that before? Oh, I'm just not a good talker. I've got literally the Hebrew here is uncircumcised lips. This time he's saying, I know that's kind of gross. Earlier he was saying, you know, I'm not good at speaking. I've got a heavy tongue. I've got like a physical problem. Here he's saying, I'm too sinful to speak. Uncircumcised lips. But the Lord said to Moses, I am the Lord. You go and tell Pharaoh, king of the Egyptians, everything I tell you. Wonder why he has to put in that part, everything, this time. Before, Moses felt like he had the liberty to change what God said. And God says, yeah, I remember when everything went wrong and you came crying to me? Let's have a do-over. Let's go back. This time, I don't want you to improvise. You're not good at that. Just repeat after me and tell Pharaoh to let the people go. But again, Moses said to the Lord, since I speak with faltering lips, why should Pharaoh listen to me? He was bound up with insecurity, shortcoming, sin. I've already blown it. I've blown it again. And now you're telling me to go to Pharaoh? He keeps bringing up the same objection. But the Lord, what does he say? He just says to Moses, you are to say everything I command you. And your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of this country. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. What are we to learn about how to persevere through failure? At the very least, four different insights. First, Moses learned how to follow God for himself before he taught others how to follow God. We can only lead people insofar as we have been led by God ourselves. Otherwise, it turns into hypocrisy. Jesus says that the disciple is not over his teacher. Now, the goal, Jesus says in John 14, is that you will do greater things than me. I want you to outdo me, is what Jesus is saying. What an audacious statement. Sinful if it didn't come from Jesus' own lips. I want you to outdo me. That's in my heart what I want. But the reality is, the disciple is not over his teacher. Moses could only take the people as far as he himself had gone. In this case, it was circumcision. I'm not saying you need to schedule an appointment with your doctor. What I'm saying is this. Is there an issue in your life that God has been extraordinarily patient with? It's sin. It's sin. You know it's sin. It's a problem. And God has just dealt with it. He said, okay, I know that's sin. You know, if God dealt with all of our sin all at once, it would be crippling. We wouldn't be able to do anything. We wouldn't be able to move. It'd be too hard to even look at. But there will be times where God will come into your life and say, okay, we haven't been dealing with this, but now we are. I'm drawing a line in the sand on this issue. And we can move no further until you address this issue. It's kind of confusing. I've had this happen more times than I can count. Where you feel like, God, you seem to be okay with that before, like it wasn't that big of a deal. In fact, I even had myself convinced it wasn't that big of an issue. And now all of a sudden, I'm hearing it in every teaching I sit through. People in my life, all of a sudden, they're bringing it up. Every time I open up my Bible, there it is. And God is saying, like a surgeon doing spiritual surgery, coming in and saying incisively, that needs to go. If something is coming to mind right now, you will not regret having a change of heart and turning to God and saying, God, I don't know how to live my life without this in it, but I want to learn how. And if you do that, you will not regret this whatsoever. This is like carrying weight on your shoulders and thinking, this is the thing that's helping me. And when you let that go, all of a sudden that integrity check, you have passed and you get into new areas with God that you didn't know before. It's amazing. It's amazing to me. People say, you know, the lights have just gone dark. I can't hear from God. I can't figure out what's wrong. And all of a sudden an issue comes up and they go to God with it, and all of a sudden everything is bright again. It's amazing. Number two, Moses learned not to improve, quote unquote, on God's words. What was with that? God will fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword? Pretty weird. I mean, I know none of us would be tempted to say God is going to judge me here. Yet we are tempted to edit or revise or omit or add to what God says in his word. I'll just say this. I have many things to say. I'll say this. God doesn't need your help when he wrote his word. And God won't work through people that deny his words. Time and time again, when people start to say, oh, we're not going to believe that. We're not going to believe this. We're going to cut that part out. That's legend. That's myth. That's abhorrent. That's this. That's that. All of a sudden, you see those churches empty. Why? Because nobody wants to go to a church where they just hear everything that they believe in the first place. They come to a time of Bible study because they want to connect with the transcendent God. Why have a God in your own image? Why even bother? See, when I come to God, I'm coming to God saying, I'm the one who doesn't know. I'm the one who's in the wrong. I'm here to learn from you. You're not here to learn from me whatsoever. Don't mess with the Word of God. That's a sin. I'll restrain myself. Number three, Moses learned to follow God despite rejection. This is a key point with failure as well. Not just when it came to Moses' enemy, Pharaoh, or the slave drivers of the Egyptians, but even his own friends. Boy, does this hurt. To have the people that you love the most are the ones turning and saying with the most derisive, scathing comments, make God judge you for leading over us. Moses is showing up saying, I'm just trying to do what God said. And his own people are turning on him. Pharaoh's turning on him. Okay, I got to ask this. Do you believe you will make an impact for Jesus Christ without experiencing rejection? If you believe that, if you think, well, if I just served in that area over there, if I just moved over here, and then I wouldn't have to face rejection, quit now. because it's never going to happen. Jesus was the one who said, if they hated me, they will hate you. Jesus said that. How can you hate a morally flawless person? They hated him. They hated Jesus. And he said, if they hate me, they're going to hate you too. At least with me, I'm a sinner. I've got all sorts of problems. It makes sense for people to hate me. But to hate Jesus, Jesus Christ, if you think that you're going to get through serving Christ without facing rejection, that really should call to mind a question in your heart. Would I be willing to do this even if other people in my life totally flaked out? Are my convictions conjoined to other people? See, Moses was a major addict of people's praise and adulation. And God had to rough him up a little bit, toughen him up, get yelled at, get chewed out, to the point where he learned how to go to God. We're going to see a totally different Moses in the chapters to come. Wait till we get to chapter 7 through 10. We see a totally different man because he had to go through this time of testing, I guess. Yeah. Finally, number 4, Moses learned to follow God with his own problems and all. Moses was convinced, it's kind of silly when you think about it, he was convinced that the problem with Pharaoh was that he just wasn't eloquent enough. He wasn't persuasive enough. You know what I mean? Like, if he could just say the right words in the right order, he could get Pharaoh to release an innumerable amount of slaves. How convincing do you have to be able to do that? And Moses is looking at himself saying, I don't have the eloquence. I'm too sinful, for one. I don't have the righteousness. I'm not persuasive. I can't talk well. He had to learn the lesson. No amount of natural human ability or ingenuity is going to be able to do a supernatural mission like that which is in front of us. Though you can't persuade a Pharaoh to release the slaves, there's no use of even opening your mouth unless God is moving powerfully. And this is a lesson that Moses learns, and he's going to keep learning it as we study through this great book.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.